I have the greatest job in the world. I am now in San Francisco getting to meet one of my favorite authors, Christopher Moore, who wrote for what is, my money, one of the top five books ever, Lamb. The story, I don't know the subtitle, the story of Christ's...
The Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal.
Right there in that title, you know, I think you get some of the attitude of his writings and maybe why I might think that book is so great. But he's written a ton of other great, great comic novels. And his recent books are Fool, the story of King Lear, basically from the Fool's point of view. And now its sequel, The Serpent of Venice, which is the Fool mashed up with Merchant of Venice and Othello. And
Cask of Amontillado.
And Cask of Amontillado. No spoilers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its eighth year, number 366, Serpent of Venice. Just before I left the Bay Area to come here to Cincinnati, I got to meet and have lunch with one of my very favorite novelists, Christopher Moore, who was gracious enough to let me talk to him about his novels, his methods, his future projects, and his approach to impertinent fans like me.
When you hear that Lamb is my favorite, does that make you go, well, screw you, what about the rest of my books?
No, I think one has to be.
Right.
You know, but what I hope my readers understand is that I couldn't just quit. You know?
Right.
It was like, you know, I mean, the best book Norman Mailer ever wrote was this first book. Should he have just stopped?
Right.
And when people say, you know, well, you know, they'll say about the latest book, well, it's good, but it's not as good as Lamb. And I'm like, Lamb is the greatest story ever told.
Yeah.
Does that show you I don't have anywhere to go with that?
Well, it's funny. I mean, our third show was the Bible, the complete Word of God abridged. And so I'm drawn, as everybody who listens to the podcast knows, we are drawn to comedy born of serious topics. And I just thought, you know, from Lamb, you approach all, many of the books from a kind of sideways. You're approaching Shakespeare sideways,
right.
sneaking in with this narrator who's impertinent. And yet, with Lamb certainly, and both with Fool and Serpent of Venice, I am strangely moved.
Well, that means just be because you're moved strangely.
That's the only way I do move, is strangely.
That's my audience right there. That's my demographic, is those who are strangely moved, or moved strangely. I don't know. I think that you have to... you have to commit, and I think that as an actor, as a performer, you understand that probably more than anybody, is that when I go to write one of these comedies, I commit to it, and I don't sort of wink, and you know, there is a breaking of the fourth wall a little bit, a sort of an inside baseball feel to both of the Shakespeare-based books, but basically the characters have to be committed to the story, and I have to be committed to the characters, and then the comedy will work.
Yes,
and though you are impertinent and irreverent, you know, with this, you're still playing it straight.
Well, for the most part, the characters are reacting to the world the way they react, and then I've created the characters, so, you know, the Fool's sort of default setting is to be a rascal.
Right.
And so it's not out of character for him to be in dire circumstances and react... in sort of a funny way. I almost regret that I didn't cut the first chapter because of Serpent of Venice, because it would open up with Pocket, my fool, being walled up in a dungeon, and him saying to the senator, the Venetian senator, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And he says, I'm walling you up. Pocket says, no, you're not. And he's clearly chained to a wall, being walled up, but he's not going to acquiesce to the fact that he's being...
You know, he will not acknowledge the reality.
He's not going to give him that.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to have to earn that by actually walling him up. So I mean, I sort of... And that's the way Pocket reacts to the world. He couldn't really be in worse circumstances, and yet he's still holding on to the fact that if I can humiliate this guy verbally, then my work is done here.
Well, now so your fool's name is Pocket of Dog Snogging.
Right. Pocket of Dog Snogging.
And that is not a name found in Shakespeare, I don't believe?
No, I just sort of, when I created a backstory for him, I wanted him to be In King Lear, you know, he's the least powerful, right. and in my book, he sort of turns that on the entire court by being the puppet master by the end of the book.
Right.
And so I also wanted him to be physically diminutive, and so he was against all odds. You know, he was not just sort of the least powerful politically, but he was the smallest, weakest, like a bit of a soggy kitten, he calls himself. And so he's raised in a nunnery, and the mother superior carries him around in the pocket of her apron when they first find him as a foundling on the doorstep, and so he is called Pocket because of that.
How much of a Shakespearean scholar are you? And as a follow-up, is that part of the fun of writing these books, is researching these books?
Oh, absolutely. I didn't know. I knew very little about Shakespeare. I think I had the broad strokes, you know, to be or not to be, you know, I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him, that sort of thing. I actually wanted to do a book about a fool, sort of generically, because of where we were in the United States politically, where I felt like the only people that were telling me the truth were comedians.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to write a book about a character who would speak truth to power. And I met with my editor in New York, and I said, look, I want to write a book about a fool, but I don't know whether to just do a fool, a generic fool, or to do King Lear's fool. And she said, oh, you have to do King Lear's fool, which was the end of it for her.
Right.
But I had to go learn the canon of Shakespeare.
Right.
And so that, it was a great opportunity. I mean, it's so great to come to these works with new eyes at, you know, being as old as I am, you know.
Well, when you're old enough to appreciate, and you're coming to it for a reason to appreciate.
Exactly. There's a motivation there.
Yeah.
To understand it and to distill it and make it accessible.
Yeah.
Which is a lot what you guys do.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of don't be afraid of this. And I had so much of that, so much trepidation about, but do I have to read King Lear before I read this? And no, you don't.
No,
just
right,
go.
Right,
just
right.
Go. It'll be fine.
Well, and for those of us who have read King Lear or seen it, and same with Merchant of Venice, I read Fool, and I'm reading Serpent of Venice right now, with this whole appreciation of, oh my gosh, for once the stories of these tragedies might come out the way I want them to come out. They might have a happy ending, and that gives me a hope that drives me through the reading of it.
Well, that's sort of what, you know, that's sort of what you want to put in there as the, it's part of the suspense. It's like, will this actually turn out okay? And will people get their proper comeuppance?
Yeah.
And proper being, you know, sort of based on how one draws the characters.
Right.
But, you don't get to... I guess I do. I was gonna say you get to rewrite Shakespeare and make it turn out the way you want to. You know,
that's right.
I think of movies I've seen that the ending is so off, like The Mission.
Yeah.
Great movie, and then at the end it's like, and then all the natives were massacred.
Wait,
you should feel bad about that.
Yeah.
400 years ago.
We met through our new mutual friend for both of us, Nicole Galland, who I did an interview with about her book I, Iago, and her book really tells the story of Othello through Iago's eyes, but sort of straight. I mean, an actor could, playing Iago, could theoretically read her book and maybe credibly get a backstory.
Right.
But that's not what you're doing here. You're doing something different.
Yeah, and I'm trying to retell the stories and mix them up with new elements, make them all a comedy.
Yeah.
You know, make everything funny. That's the first rule of what I do.
Yeah.
And then there's a little bit, I kind of wanted to talk to you about this because of, I think people in the theater are familiar with the performance of Shakespeare. I'm hoping that it's something that they like, and that's using the chorus as a character.
Yeah.
I have, you know, the chorus in this, and in the Shakespeare plays that have the chorus, Romeo and Juliet and Henry V, he sort of wanders blithely through the scenery, and no one notices that this guy is bombastically, you know, speaking about what's going on. And so I put a chorus in here and have, you know, people sort of go, who is that loony walking through? And I sort of wondered, did that resonate with you when you first ran across that in the
book? Absolutely. And it made it, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but it also made it seem very stage-worthy.
Right.
The fact that you're playing with the chorus in that way.
There was a scene in Fool where there's an intermission.
Right.
And it's clearly, the action has stopped and the characters are still in character.
Yeah.
And Edmund is saying to the fool, well, so this is a comedy I'm in? And the fool is saying, well, for the rest of us, yes. For you, unfortunately, no. And it's sort of nobody seemed to have any problem with that.
Right.
It was and I really thought, because it truly breaks the fourth wall.
Hello, I'm Adrian Scarborough, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSE the RSE? For these last weeks of 2013, you can see us perform the ultimate Christmas show abridged in Galesburg, Illinois, and Reston, Virginia. And until December 29th, the world premiere of the complete history of comedy abridged at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Christopher Moore as we continue to talk about Pocket of Dog Snugging, the hero of Fool, Moore's retelling of King Lear, and his new novel, The Serpent of Venice.
Pocket is like the Zelig of the Forrest Gump of Shakespeare. He knows all the characters.
Right, he does. And the books are sort of, they draw quotes from all different plays. In fact, there's a point where Iago says to Emilia in a laundry in the castle under the I have it on this island. It's in Corsica. In the play, it's in Cyprus. Mm-hmm. And he says, "Methinks the lady doth protest too much," and which is from Hamlet. You know, right, and then both of the Shakespeare books draw from. You know, I have the weird sisters that show up in Fool, and this one has sort of when it was convenient.
Yeah.
You know, I have sort of the iconic lines that had to stay. You know, all that glisters or glitters is not gold.
And
you know the green eyed monster and those sort of iconic lines I kept in both books.
How did the idea to come about to extend the story of Pocket from just King Lear to now Othello, Merchant of Venice, and Edgar Allan Poe?
Well, I think the main thing was this was really kicked off by being in Venice. I had gone to I'd been invited to the Mantua Literary Festival, and so I'm in northern Italy, and my wife and I went to Venice, and I thought, well, this is a great place for a monster story.
Yeah.
And I start thinking about what the next book is going to be, and my readers are always clamoring for, you know, sequel to this or a sequel to that.
Okay.
And I started to think, well, you know, there's a sort of a history with Venice and mm-hmm. Shakespeare,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to see if it would work to move Pocket in the end of the 13th century, which is where I set Fool, to Venice. And it turned out it was great. It was a much better time to set it than Shakespeare sets it, which is the mid 16th century.
Yeah.
And so having Othello and Merchant of Venice happen, and then once I started working in that sort of meme that it's going to be a monster story, I thought, well, there's already been a horror story with a fool set in Venice, and that's the Cask of Amontillado. And I thought, well, let's see if I can do that. And so it sort of ends up with all the historical things that happen in the late 13th century in Venice, which is they're trying to propagate a crusade because they're sort of the Halliburton of their time.
Yeah, the Venetians.
Yeah, the Venetians
are. Yeah.
And Marco Polo is there, they've had these massive naval battles and almost gone under, and so it was convenient to make Othello be their savior, which they imply in the play that he is.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of things that fell into place, and then it was the idea of bringing those two plays in. And
see, research is the fun part.
It is. It absolutely is. Yeah. It absolutely is. This book really became an exercise in putting puzzle pieces together because there were so many elements that I wanted to keep.
Yeah.
I wanted really to develop the Desdemona character more because she's. I had seen a performance in London at the Old Globe with Zoe Tapper playing Desdemona, and she was just brilliant. Mm. Just a revelation, you know, to not be too theatrical about it. And I thought, well, that character deserves that.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't able to do it.
Right.
There's just so many things that that had to go into this to make it work.
Well, but as you've mentioned before, you know, your Desdemona is a little saucier than perhaps she is more virginally played.
Well, and exactly, and as you point out, why else is Othello attracted to her?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, well, she's interested. He says in the play, you know, she gave me pity. She showed, you know, I told her my story and she gave me pity, you know.
But she's got to be fun to chat with, otherwise you don't just put her up on a pedestal and, I mean, maybe he did, maybe that's his track.
But she's hot. Yeah. We know that. I mean, her father tells us she's hot.
Right.
You know, in no uncertain terms.
Creepy.
Yeah, he basically says, she could have had any of the curly-haired darlings or something of of Venice, and
she got the nappy-haired darling.
So. You know, and then it was logical in bringing in Merchant that, you know, Portia and Desdemona are the same character.
Yeah, right.
Socially.
Yeah.
They're exactly the same character. So to make them sisters was not a problem at all.
I know. That was a wonderful thing that you've made them sisters. And also, and I think you give Portia what I feel she deserves a little bit. I haven't finished the book, so I don't know exactly what she gets. But you're already treating her with a less respect than I think she is normally given, and I applaud that, sir.
Well, she has that brilliant speech at the trial in, you know, the quality of mercy is not strained, which sort of redeems her for being a bit of a racist twat for the rest of the play, and a whiner, and so you know, she's a brat.
Right, she is a brat.
She's a brat, and that's what you have to sort of I have to react to that, you know.
Well, and you acknowledge the fact that this whole pick the best casket business is ridiculous and farcical, and it doesn't make any sense. And why all these serious productions of Merchant never deal with that, I don't understand.
Yeah, once you started to get into the logic, and this sort of came to me in redoing Lear as well, a lot of it doesn't make sense. And the probably the worst project of trying to make sense was to do the Gospels.
Yes.
And to make a credible timeline of what happens in the four Gospels.
Well, and again, going back to the Lamb, that whole section of the book, Jesus is missing years. All read incredibly to me. It was one of the more credible theories I've ever heard of what happened to Jesus during that time, and it does influence what I understand his teachings to be. I mean, I thought it was a masterwork of comic novelry, if that's a word. It's not.
It is now.
It is now. Theology.
Well, that's great. I mean, I was really thinking when I was writing it that I was going to end up in the Salman Rushdie suite at the Hyatt, you know, and it would just be the two of us in there going, well, do you think they're going to try and blow us up today? And as it turned out, I mean, they're teaching Lamb at like Harvard Divinity, and you know, all these different seminaries. So
that's awesome.
And you know, that's flattering to me because most of those colleges wouldn't ever let me in. I mean, my approach to King Lear was, okay, we have all the action of King Lear, and we have the fool being the point of view character, and his goal, because as a novelist, you always have to ask yourself, the same as you do as an actor, what does the character want?
Right.
And what the character wanted was to shag all three of the princesses.
Yeah.
So if I put him on the island in the Tempest, it's got to be, you know, Ariel, and what's the daughter's name?
Oh my God.
Oh no, I'm blanking. Everybody listening to this is going, it's this person, you idiots. Well, Brave New World that has such.
Damn. Is it Miranda?
Maybe it's Miranda.
I think it's Miranda.
Woo! Nail it.
All right. High five.
So you were telling me that Fool, that Pocket, might come to the stage.
Yeah, I'm adapting it with a friend right now. And I don't know where we're going to bring it to the stage. But I'm excited about it. I worked for... We adapted a few scenes and did a stage reading at the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey.
Okay.
And working with the actors was such a revelation to me. They brought so much to it. I mean, from the three read-throughs that we did, it got so much better.
Sure.
And that's something that, as a novelist, you don't have. You know, you're in a room by yourself for 18 months, you write a joke, and then 18 months later, you find out whether it was funny or not. And to be able
it's
to
true.
Polish the lines with somebody who's got... they have an instrument. They can say it 1,000 different ways, and they're happy to do that.
Yeah.
It's just something I've never experienced.
What changed? Did you find that actors can tell it in a way that shortens what you have written? They don't need to use as many words. I'm always about reducing, as you know.
Timing.
Timing.
A lot of it is comic timing and where to put emphasis.
Yeah.
Cutting is a big part of it.
Sure.
A big part of it. And Lear has a lot of bombastic speeches in it, and even though I cut them for the book, when they're starting to be read aloud and they're in the midst of a lot of comic lines, you realize we don't have the luxury of three more breaths. And I, not to be too inside baseball, but that's really what it was just that it got so much better because the comic timing was improved by the performance of the actors.
Right. How little do you need to tell the story?
Exactly. And how much can they bring to it with, even in a stage reading where you don't have blocking, they can bring an enormous amount with with facial expressions and action and inflection that you just don't have on the page. I mean, what you have for timing, comic timing on the page is he said.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. Right. It's true.
Wow. This is that. That's. See, I love that kind of inside baseball stuff because that's really fascinating.
Well, and I'm excited about doing it. Yeah. I mean, I really want to, you know, get out there and workshop this with a company.
Well, I can only imagine. I mean, your books are filled with such great dialogue. I mean, it's just, I mean, one of the appeals of them are the funny dialogue, which seem to translate easily to the stage, but of course we know that it's not quite as easy as that.
Well, and just the idea of working with other people and making it better and better and better and better, which is the guy I'm working with, Joe Disher, who was a creative director for New Jersey Shakes for years, 20 years, I think. Yeah. You know, he wants to workshop the whole book. And I said, no, Joe, I think we're going to need to cut it because it's right now I think it's an 8-hour play.
Yeah, right.
which is, you know, I'm not Tom Stoppard. I can't pull that off.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Chris Moore's new novel, The Serpent of Venice, will be published in April 2014, but it's available for pre-order now at both Amazon.com and Amazon.co.uk. And you must also check out his previous novels, Fool, Sacre Bleu, Bloodsucking Fiends, Practical Demon Keeping, Island of the Sequined Love Nun, and many others, plus my personal favorite, because one of them has to be, Lamb, The Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal. Then send us your favorite comic novels via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks as always to webmaster Matt Rippey, blood-sucking fiend Matthew Croke, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Susan Jolly. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Adrian Scarborough, who starting next month in January 2014 will be playing the real fool, Shakespeare's fool, in the National Theatre production of King Lear, starring Simon Russell Beale and directed by Sam Mendes. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 366 1098ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. This podcast is for you, Lisa Croak.
So, final question, will we see Pocket of Dog Snogging end up on Prospero's Island in The Tempest?
That's a possibility. I mean, when I wrote Fool, I didn't know I was going to do the Serpent of Venice. And I like writing the character a lot. He's sort of the delivery system for that British, over-the-top sense of humor that I so appreciate. Going back, you know, as far as the goons.
Yeah.
And so he could show up. I don't know if it would be The Tempest. I mean, you think about, am I just going to throw all caution to the wind? Midsummer Night's Dream. Because, you know, because it could it get goofier? Yes, it could.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.